that potlatch began with the usual dances and rituals. The usual dances and rituals were often dances and rituals held by the chiefs and held by other families and passed on to the next generation. The drummer's circle vibrated in the human bodies that sat on the benches along the sides of the hall. The chief's thunderbird dance flashed in the black and red of the cedar headdress and cape. The eagle down, which comes up off of the mast, was drifting about and onto the top of our heads and across us. The power and the grace of the dancers. A princess training in the law at University of Victoria. A young chief's son fishing in his father's 30-foot troller were a sign of their ascesis, their disciplined and deeply contemplative art. Their powerful legs sprang up from half crouch and back again with arms, wing-like, whirling capes, a strong and fluent witness to the spirit and wisdom of this community of ocean and mountains. And then the clowns. 85-year-old David Frank, 80-year-old James Adams that took the floor, brought to the solemnity of the sacred Thunderbird dancers a comic yet crucial counterpoint. Their mimicry and exaggerations were raucous, raven replies to the majesty of the Thunderbird and Eagle. Theirs was a commentary on the hubris hidden even in the most sacred dances and rites. They came to remind the community that no technique or plan could ever capture or control the spiritual powers of the natural world. Holy fools teach us to laugh at our attempts to calculate the circumference of the sacred world. With laughter, these two opened both of my European eyes to see the dark and shadowed ways of the spirit in flesh. Ravens show in all their ingenious plans and inventions the unpredictable gifts of life. Raven shows all actions, calculated or uncalculated, bring the unforeseen and deepen mystery. James's teasing hip twists and David's taunting feather flaps release the hall from despair into a world of hope beyond expectation. The human ethos is rooted in a mythos, a sacred dance and story that opens up upon a reality that contains humanity, but itself cannot be contained. The boisterous hip thrusts and mocking feather flips expose the pretenses and hubris of this European cleric, that fisherman, that band administrator, that elder, that commoner, that chief, and that shaman alike. We do not hold the keys to sacred powers. We may dance the steps of wisdom or participate in the sacred dance of the spirits, but we can neither control nor own the spirits. We can either make room for them in our hearts or harden our souls. All of this I had come to expect in the potlatch. However, I was unprepared for the coming crisis in my single-eyed vision that the entrance of the wolves would bring. Their entrance was marked by the ceasing of any sound or movement in the crowded hall. The video camera, an instrument allowed as a tool recorded for future generations, even the most sacred dances of the killer whale and thunderbird were videotaped. It was turned off. In fact, all electronic mechanical devices were switched off and the lights were blacked out. In the darkness of the hall, a vibration thrummed in the corrugated steel walls and the air was filled with sparks of lightning and a low howling. The digital god Kronos no longer governed, but his mother, Kairos, now danced in all the fullness of her dark body. Origins met endings. Earth met sea, sky, and all the elements took up the beat of drum and heart. The world of my professional techniques, my technologies, and the regulations that I obey was exposed as a distortion, a fabrication, and a distracting game. The power of the wolf entered, a wild yet disciplined art. I understood, perhaps I didn't, that what Rudolf Otto reclaimed of the word awe and the presence of the mysterium tremendum. The blurring of my single vision came as Blake's fourfold vision was given me. The technically ordered and calculated world in which I could make room for the potlatch as a museum piece or an interesting artifact to be examined and classified, it collapsed. And that night, with the disappearance of the seven who survived with the wolves, taken in order that a balance might return to the cosmos. And that night, I lost my grip on the world, only to find myself within a larger and sacred epiphanous dance. Save for a few closing remarks, we quietly moved to our homes to wait. No lahal was played, no gifts distributed. As on Good Friday, the gathered community simply left into the darkness to seek hope without expectation. Saturday passed as a vigil. Children asked where fathers and grandfathers had disappeared to, but no answers were spoken. Sunday's dawn broke, an early spring sun warming the rocks and our hopes. I entered an empty church, save for James, and without words, he took me to the sacred shore. The world of the gift was in the surf breaking and the invisible dance of dark and light, spirit and form gathered on the shore. Thomas Merton writes, "It is true that neither the ancient wisdoms nor the modern sciences are complete in themselves. They do not stand alone. They call for one another. Without wisdom, science is unable to penetrate the full sapiential meaning of the created and material cosmos. And science, without wisdom, leaves man enslaved to a world of unrelated objects in which there is no way of discovering order or deep significance." My time in the potlatch societies of the West Coast brought me to confusion about the tradition and science I carried in my one-eyed dance on the earth. Though I never felt I represented very well this one-eyed giant of Western religion and thought, my vision was clearly handicapped by its monitored vision. As my wife and I were initiated into the potlatch dances, we began to see into a world of primordial depth and ineffable, yet relational power. The highly rational, exegetical, and juridical religious pattern I was trained in that seminary, and by my religious order as an ordained United Church cleric, was able to accept indigenization as an interesting ethnic feature and a politically important advance. The adding of local color and custom was an addition that required no profound change in awareness and no disturbance of the soul. Merton writes, "If we want to bring together what is divided, we cannot do so by imposing one division upon the other, or absorbing one division into the other. But if we do this, the union, in Merton's words, it's not Christian. It is political and doomed to further conflict. We must contain all divided worlds in ourselves and transcend them. Indigenization was then and is still, I would argue, a political agenda item in the larger project of absorbing First Nations peoples into the institutional forms of the church and European society. It is a project defined by the texts and projects of Western ideology. The technique of the gospel of liberation, the devices of salvation that I learned so well, are applications, are apps, intended to erase the other in a culturally sensitive manner, murdering softly and subtly by reducing difference to an exchange of artifacts and signs. This is the imposition of one division upon the other. It is a political move made to reduce the other to a set of signs. Signs are exchangeable. Symbols and living communities are not. In the politics of indigenization, the divided worlds are not allowed to enter into ourselves. Rather, they are colonized by the institution as signs of an inclusion. The political tactic of indigenization is a way that dominant culture uses to expunge guilt and maintain control of the other. The constructed self, the self as defined by a pattern of consumption and fabrication, is not transcended. Merton exposed, as the experience of the wolves exposed to me, the deep division within this constructed self. The crucifixion of this self came in my confusion and deep sense of disorientation and loss. Unless I was prepared to sacrifice my will to power, attend completely to the truth of the other without attempting to control the outcome, I was merely making a political move and ensuring further violence and conflict. But the profound consequences of emptying out the constructed self, of deconstructing all that I had counted as gain, as loss, came as the terrifying grace of encounter with spirits unmapped by my theology. The world of the gift, Godboot again, exposed my retreat from the deep engagement of gifts. On encountering the world of potlatch, its spiritual relatedness and depth, my vision was blurred by dimensions my single-eye training had prepared me against but could not prevent. My gaze, having lost confidence in the penetrating technical power of a prescriptive theology, could no longer define the edges of things. All reality seemed involved in a dance that moved through and beyond sight and analysis. No longer able to gaze upon the world with a sharp clarity of the devices of technique, I found myself losing faith in the technical power of my theology. I lost confidence in the constructs and suffered a fundamental loss of faith in the religious systems I carried. I tasted a chaotic shifting of forms that were half exposed and half in shadow. I fell into a wild sea of relational and sacred intensity beyond the discursive genius of my Protestant thesis. I entered a time of mental and spiritual crisis. The obsessive technical precision, the theological certitudes I once proclaimed, seemed in this world to be a form of mental derangement. The apophatic sanity and discipline of the wolves made the clarity of my liberation theology, my Christian Marxism,
appear to be but the manic episode of a bipolar consciousness. When I voyaged back into the order of shopping malls and city grids, this personally felt derangement appeared to be the rule of an entire culture. Again, Merton writes, the split of the European mind has become universal. All are caught in the fundamental division between deliberate, frantic activity organized by the lifeless abstractions, techniques, and ideologies, static concepts, and the instinctive and spontaneous life. It is a crisis of sanity, first of all. The problems of the nations are the problems of mentally deranged people, but magnified 1,000 times because they have the full, straight-faced approbation of a schizoid society, schizoid national structures, schizoid military and business complexes, and need one add, schizoid religious sects. We are at war with ourselves, said Kumaraswamy, and therefore at war with one another. Western, I'll use the word people, he doesn't, is and are